Price drop? Time to shop. Get to a Nordstrom Rack store today for first dibs on new markdowns. Now score even more, up to 70% off brands everyone loves at Nordstrom Rack. Denim, dresses, sneakers, tops, and more. Plus, get genius deals on jackets, sweaters, and boots for the whole family. Shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and save up to 70% with new markdowns. But hurry, deals this great won't last.
Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at Breezeline.com.
Remember, kids, we're what you call experts. Don't try this at home.
Hey, it's me, your exploding toilet bruiser, Holden McNeely. How's it going, everybody? I got a bunch of shit in me. Oh, God, now I'm in a bunch of pieces. What's happening here? It's the Mythbusters episode.
On this exciting episode of Wizard and the Bruiser, our intrepid hosts see if they can summarize the 2000s most iconic sci-fi infotainment show and not go into an existential hole about how the 2000s represented the last moment of American idealism.
That's right. But it's true. Welcome to our Mythbusters episode. Of course, we had to do this at some point. This is like another one of those. Time is strange, you know? Mm-hmm. You'll grow up being told one thing. Hey, if you do this, you're a nerd. If you act like this, you're not. People don't like you. People don't like enthusiasm about things like anything, much less science or problem solving or, you know, taking things apart and putting them back together again. That makes you a nerd, and no one likes you nerds. And then you get out of high school and you go to college and you're like, oh, I'm not even into that nerd stuff. I'm cool. I listen to jazz music and I smoke jazz weed, and you know what I mean? I do all that kind of stuff, and I'm one of those cool guys, you know what I mean? And then you get out of college and you look around, and all of a sudden everyone's like, nerds are cool now. And you're like, what? What are you talking about? I thought we were like super not cool. Oh, I can be, wait, I'm a nerd. And they're like, no, you're not. You're one of those cool guys. You listen to jazz music and smoke that jazz weed. And I'm like, wait a second. I'm cool. I like all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that was like Nerdist and, you know, just in the MCU and all those things. And Mythbusters, I think, is such a big part of that wave, right? Where like, finally, it was cool, not just like acceptable, but kind of cool to be like excited about like science stuff. And, you know, you could be this like, I'm a big ol' glasses wearing bearded nerd boy with a silly hat that loves, you know, blowing stuff up. And it's celebrated in this amazing way. I think Mythbusters was like doing that. Mythbusters was the hipster of cool nerds. They were like doing that before it was even a big deal. I mean, the show started in 2003. I was still in college and nerds were still nerds, you know what I mean? But over time, it became this phenomenon and this widely, not just, again, not just acceptable, but like super cool thing that everybody was watching together and was unified in liking and became this like, you know, memeable thing online and people love supporting these big old nerds, and it's kind of blows me away, and I love it for that.
I was the target audience of Mythbusters when it came out. I loved this show profoundly, and it was exactly in my wheelhouse. And we know we're talking 2003, we're talking 2004. I'm also in college. I'm downloading episodes of One Piece and Naruto on Kazaa on my college network. I am going on Dig and Reddit and like actively engaging with atheism memes. Like that was a bold new thing that was exciting. companies like Facebook were kind of coming into their own, and the web 2.0 was expanding, and it was these cool startups that were disrupting everything. And it was all based out of Silicon Valley. It was just all of this idealism and excitement in the nerd community, and it hadn't been subsumed yet. And Mythbusters was 100% the front row of that cultural movement, because, you know, these were people that worked at worked on Star Wars movies for ILM. These are people that like went ahead and made a bunch of like internet references in the middle of the show. And what really made the show compelling for me was that it married the kind of Bill Nye the Science Guy, Mr. Wizard, Beakman's World style science edutainment with a more raw reality TV based kind of format. You know, it wasn't just like, hey, did you know that if you mix vinegar with baking soda, it goes fizzy? Like, This was explosions and violence, and there was a redhead girl who was super cute. The our hosts were constantly injuring themselves. They were constantly injuring others, as we'll get into. It was the real world. It was Jackass. It was Beakman's World, all rolled into one.
Yeah.
And the point of the show was this procedural process of a scientific method from beginning to end. And in the case of most of these episodes, multiple ones all at once. So, like, it wasn't about messy human emotions. It wasn't about, like, characters being like, oh, I wish I could tell Gwendolyn how I feel. Like, for a nerd who was, like, scared of the world, who was scared of everything, the Mythbusters TV program was a source of, like, consistency and excitement, hosted by a group of friends that you felt that you could be friends with, even though, as we'll get into multiple times, Adam and Jamie were not friends. They were not friends at all. The sheer accidentalness of this show and the way that it became a cultural phenomenon out of like thin air, where just one weird instant led to another and snowballed to this group of like weird builders and makers becoming these media darlings, is a fascinating story, and one that I didn't know before we did the research, and it really made me appreciate just what this show represented. And you know, it feels like there's a million versions of this show that they've done since. I know Tori Carey and Grant Imahara did something for Netflix called The White Rabbit.
The White Rabbit Project, yeah.
There was like the slow-mo time. There was all these like attempts to recapture that magic, and it never quite worked out. Although the legacy of Mythbusters is 100% alive and well on YouTube. There's creators like Mark Rober and the Backyard Scientists and Niall Red, who all have millions and millions of viewers, like millions of subs, probably dwarfing by an exponential factor the original cable audience of Mythbusters, doing this same kind of procedural, like, hey, we're going to build a thing. These are the scientific forces involved in building the thing. And we're going to end on a fancy slow-mo shot of it exploding. And so it's this kind of weird niche of media, this science-tainment niche that Mythbusters embodies that I find fascinating. And one of the things that I love the most about this show are the moments where even they're surprised at what's happening, where they can actually get a balloon made of lead to fly, when they shoot a cannon at 50 miles per hour out of the back of a truck that is also going 50 miles per hour, and the ball just stops in midair. Because that's how physics works, even though you don't think that's how it should work.
Yeah.
It's just incredibly satisfying when things explode. It's incredibly interesting when scientific principles you get to see in motion in HD for in front of your eyes. And it's charming that this, you know, weird guy from Indiana in a beret and his former child actor clown friend get to just engage with the kind of things that, you know, they'll do tests based on YouTube videos and Reddit posts and interact with the audience in a way that makes them way more available than a lot of other celebrities. If you weren't there for it, I don't know if watching an episode now still has the sway that it did when I needed a show like Mythbusters. But dear God, going through the episodes and watching hour after hour after hour of this show was a weirdly nostalgic comfort. Also terrifying because I feel like at my most depressed when Mythbusters was on.
I mean, it's a good show for that. And I was also going to say it's a great, because it is that great show that can just be on all day. Like you can just, in the family living room, in the middle of a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, perfect show. Whole family can be in and out of it. You know, it's great for that and great for depression watching because it's just constant, you know, stimuli, constant just comfort food TV. And there's, oh my God, so many hours of it as well. I mean, they damn did they bust some fucking myths, dude. The show ran from 2003 to for almost 300 episodes and 17 seasons. It finally officially ended, I believe, in 2018. There was like one season with new hosts that were picked from a reality TV competition. We'll get into that. But man, I mean, they put so much time and work into that thing. It's like kind of unbelievable. And there's just an endless amount of it at this point. And again, like I said, I briefly mentioned before, but such a great show for like, here's a crazy clip for Reddit right now that would just play really well for an internet audience as well. For, you know, so it's just kind of undeniable in that way. I'm glad we're finally doing an episode on it because, again, I love like cool nerd stuff, and it's like not like they act cool, they act incredibly nerdy and it was somehow just the way it was put out and the way it was done was just they were cool, and I like admire that and so much because I hid the nerdiness aspects of myself for a while there in my life, you know, so I admire people like this, people who make it cool. So Mythbusters, yeah, science entertainment television program developed by Peter Rees, which premiered on Discovery Channel. The host, special effects experts Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman, and the B team behind them use the scientific method to test out myths, movie scenes, adages, and more to see how they hold up. So a lot of it too, we're about to get into the nitty gritty, but I'll just really quickly say a lot of it too is exploring myths based on Hollywood, based on television and film. And all, a lot of these guys worked at Industrial Light and Magic. They worked on a bunch of movies and things like that. So it's a lot of fun. And again, I think that the application to action movies and things like that, again, is just makes it so entertaining as opposed to just like Bill Nye in the lab, right? Mm-hmm. Which was also entertaining to a certain degree, but you know what I mean? It's a lot cooler when it's like, remember that fucked thing that happened in Armageddon? Let's see if that holds up at all, you know?
One myth that I remember was they just did a whole episode about whether or not you can actually curve bullets by swinging your arm while you fire the gun, like in the movie Wanted.
Yes, love it.
And I'm just would that work? Let's find out. It doesn't. It doesn't at all.
Sometimes it does, you know, in that case, no. But yeah, a lot of times you're like, whoa, I can't believe that. Like if you could jump into a pool of water to avoid the blast of a shockwave.
Oh, yeah.
Which actually did work. And that's kind of such a TV thing that you would totally think would be like, well, that's probably bullshit.
If you're falling off a high like structure into water, could you throw your like tools or whatever you have on you to break the surface tension of the water before you hit it, and that'll like stop you from snapping your neck? Maybe. One thing I actually remember that sticks with me to today is they did a myth of if you drive your car, it's the water myths that are actually weirdly stick with me.
Yeah.
If you are getting shot at, you should dive into water because a handgun bullet at the very least will actually break apart upon hitting the water because of the difference in density. If your car drives into a lake, don't wear yourself out trying to struggle because the pressure differential will keep the door shut. What you have to do is just stay calm, wait until the cabin floods, and then the pressure will differentiate and the door will open normally. So like that's like a weird thing I learned off of Mythbusters. And
weird.
A woman actually claims that that episode of Mythbusters saved her and her daughter's life when that happened to her. And she remembered the advice from the show.
That's amazing. All right, here we go. Let's get into it. The early history. It came about in a pretty interesting way. First of all, we've got Peter Rees, I mentioned before. He is an Australian writer and producer. Back in 1993, he won the Charles Heidsieck International Travel Challenge for circumnavigating the globe by land and sea in 100 days and turned that into a documentary called Champagne Charlie. And I like that we start here with this crazy thing, circumnavigating the globe in 100 days, because he, along with the rest of this crew, a lot of them have like these really interesting, they're like world travelers. Mm. They are rebels and renegades in a lot of ways. And it's just really fascinating that this crew is so ragtag. Like not many of them were like, oh, they were just this like cute, pretty looking actor. And they ended up becoming this like avid science person. In fact, none of them really have that background, right? They're all like kind of have these weird entries into Hollywood that brought them to Mythbusters. Before Peter Reese did that, he graduated the Circumnavigating the Globe. He graduated from the Australian Film, Television and Radio School. Initially, the series Reese pitched to the Discovery Channel was called Tall Tales or True, and this actually focused on exploring urban myths and legends, so similar but not exactly the same. However, Discovery had already greenlit a similar concept, so that is what forced him to go and refine his pitch to focus on key elements of myths and the use of science to debunk or prove them, and applied it more to like films and things like that and television shows, and expanded outside of urban legends in the realm of those things. And yeah, so the Discovery then gave him the go-ahead to develop 3 episodes as a pilot project, so he needs to now gather the people to make it happen.
So it's interesting that Reese worked for a company called Beyond Productions, and Beyond was this incredibly long-running Australian kind of science news magazine show. The closest I can think of is like Nova from WGBH Boston in America, where it was just this, here's a bunch of new and interesting, here's things from the world of science. And when he was talking about getting the show made, he says in an interview with none other than the Christian Science Monitor, this is an article from 2006, he says that the host criteria was the total opposite of a normal television host. We wanted someone who had a shop, someone who could build anything we wanted, but we didn't want a scientist. And in his travels, he never forgot a number in a Rolodex, because for Beyond Productions, they covered the exciting world of, it wasn't called BattleBots at the time, it was called Robot Wars. And it was there that he met a mustachioed man in a beret named Jamie Hyneman.
A goat with a mustache. Yeah. Jamie Hyneman grew up in Indiana and was a wild child who didn't love that he lived out in the middle of nowhere with no neighbors for miles. Hyneman said, "If I was mowing the lawn, I figured out that if I repeatedly ran the mower into the tree, that something would break and I would no longer have to mow the lawn because the lawnmower was broken. I was a problematic kid, to be sure. I left home when I was 14 and hitchhiked all over the country." He was, when he left home, he was gone for 6 months until he ended up in juvie in California, juvenile detention facility, at which point his parents went and picked him up and brought him back home.
He has, whatever his childhood was like, there is something very, there's like a darkness there that you rarely get a glimpse of, except there's a few long form interviews online. But it basically boils down to he ran away from home, got caught in California. His parents brought him back and basically said, "We understand you're going stir crazy. We wish you could stay and work on our family apple orchard, but apparently that's not in the cards for you. We're going to take you to a 6-week survivalist course in the wilderness. Huh. And if you get through that, we're going to give you the keys to one of the cars, and like whatever your life is, that's your life." So that's where like his first taste for like practicality and like and hacking things together, this kind of like wilderness guy that's part of the Jamie Hyneman lore, comes from. Shortly after that, his mother, a librarian, died, and it left him with a small inheritance, and he decided to buy a local pet shop. Mm. And he claims that it was that experience, the mundanity of small business ownership, of just working day in, day out, of like just having to tend to the 8 individual, you know, got to feed the animals, got to scoop their shit, got to stock the shelves, got to bury the dead ones, got to talk to customers day in, day out, gave him this intense distaste for an average 9-to-5.
Uh-huh.
It was like at that moment that he was like, I don't want to do a traditional job. And he sought to find a way to kind of break out of that mold, which led him to become a boat captain and dive master.
Yeah, yeah. He did end up actually also going to Indiana University and got a degree in Russian linguistics.
That's key. That is also key.
Yes, absolutely. And it started just exactly, Jay, kind of going around doing different things. We've got the dive master. He was a concrete inspector, apparently a chef, machinist, animal wrangler, all these sorts of things before he eventually lands in a career in special effects.
Oh, okay. So he talks about this also in one of his interviews where he gets a taste for making things. He understands that he wants to like create sculptures and machines and devices. And he literally sits himself down and asks, like, what is the most commercially viable way for my work to be seen, engaged with, and sold? Because he has this deep fear of being adrift. It's like a very kind of like, I don't know if he's technically a boomer, but like this idea that, you know, if he fails, he has to go back to the orchard. He has to go back to the pet shop. Like, what is the most commercially viable way to engage with this desire? And he settles on special effects and he goes to Colossal Pictures, which is this San Francisco based production shop that mostly that is kind of based in the counterculture of the area. It's one of their first jobs is to create the opening sequence for the Grateful Dead movie in 1977. Like, it's kind of this hippy dippier version of Industrial Light and Magic, which is also kind of getting off the ground. And he gets a start just mopping the floors and cleaning up. He just shows up day one and is like, I will do all the grunt work, all the bullshit that you don't want to do. And he says he did that specifically because that means he'll know where everything is. And that means he's indispensable. And he sticks with this company all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And Colossal Pictures eventually hits hard times. They lose creative people in the dot-com boom that they start their own internet production companies. The Colossal Pictures hits a massive loss when the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame refused to pay bills for a bunch of displays and films that they made for the museum. They file Chapter 11 bankruptcy and limps along until Jamie Hyneman, who was by then had the role of manager of the model shop, bought the company from them and turned it into what we know as M5 Industries.
Yes, yes. And it should be known, some of his credits are in films like Naked Lunch, Flubber. He did effects work on the Matrix trilogy. And all of this kind of running out of San Francisco. Cut to Adam Savage, grew up in New York and was really into acting as a kid. He got to voice animated characters for his dad, who did animation work for Sesame Street. So it was very early on he was getting work because of that. He also did like some commercials and stuff doing his own right as well, but he ends up falling out of acting at the end of his teens. However, as he quote, had passed on that in favor of doing stuff with my hands. This started out with his bike at a local bike shop. A local bike shop taught him how to take apart and put a bike back together, and he was able to do it on his own pretty quickly after that. At age 18, Savage also broke his neck in a swimming accident, which he survived without any long-term consequences, but again, I think fed into this whole thing about how he could, you know, take a knock on the head and keep moving. After school, Savage got into the film business wearing several hats such as animator, graphic designer, carpenter, projectionist, film developer, and set designer, but started out as a model maker, eventually doing stuff on Galaxy Quest, The Mummy, and The Matrix Reloaded. He essentially got a name for himself early on as this guy who could build odd props, stuff that no one else was making. He was great, again, working with his hands and thinking outside of the box. One thing that was cited was a remote control recliner as an example of that. And Adam said, Jamie and I have known each other since about 1993 or 1994, and Jamie actually gave me my first job in the film industry, my first real job doing model making. I had spent about 3 years with him cutting my teeth on commercials. We probably did about 120 commercials while I was working for him. And somewhere in the middle there, I helped him build a robot that became a very legendary robot in the original BattleBots, the precursor to Robot Wars. And this robot was called Blendo. An Australian film crew sent out a team to interview us about Robot Wars. And of course, that is Peter Reese and crew. Blendo, let's talk about it.
Justin, and so good. Thousands of spring deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save big today on new arrivals from Kate Spade New York, Nike, Sam Edelman, Free People, and Madewell, starting at only $30. Great brands and great prices on dresses, denim, sandals, designer bags, and more. So rack your look and get first dibs on spring styles you want now from just $30 at your Nordstrom Rack store. What will you find?
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Okay, so you might remember BattleBots. There's a few typical designs for what a BattleBot is made of. The most popular one is usually like a wedge shape that can just flip over the competition. Some have like buzz saws like coming out the side. Others have like striking little hammers on it. Some even have flamethrowers. What Jamie did with Blendo was that he took a lawnmower engine and attached it to a massive steel flywheel that barely hovered like less than a centimeter above the ground. So its center of gravity was extremely low and it was spinning this heavyweight at massive RPM. So anything that remotely touched this thing or one of its stubby little blades would just have all that energy transferred to it immediately and just get shattered. It was like they basically had to ban it after a while because it wasn't fun, because it was like, all right, well, now it's time for the machine that shatters the other machines and risks the audience's health because it's going to send bits of gasoline and metal flying everywhere.
Jamie Heidemann described it as, quote, a piece of steel the size of a fist traveling at the speed of sound. And yeah, it was actually also it was withdrawn also because it was sending its opponent's pieces flying into the audience like shrapnel. Yeah. It was so powerful that people were like, we can't, this is a danger. So they gave it like a special award because they were like, the thing you built is so fucked that we're scared of injuring the audience because it's so powerful, this little machine.
Another thing about early Jamie and Adam is that the actual name for M5 Industries was supposedly coined by Adam when it was time to rename the studio. And he thought he was like trying to suggest the name of a British Secret Service agency, having misremembered that it's MI6, not M5. But now if you go to the M5 Industries website, or at least at one point in 2000, the M5 stands for models, machines, miniatures, manufacturing, and yes, a little bit of magic. Heinemann talks about that a lot of studios in the Bay Area closed, a lot like how Colossal Pictures did. They would get a big commercial job or a big movie job, kind of outspend itself or like kind of get too big for its britches and collapse when times were leaner. And so M5 was kind of this smaller kind of deal. He ran the place he did not like expand very often. It was the same shop the whole time. He worked with a lot of younger artists just getting into the industry that were less experienced, but he was willing to foster them. He was willing to take advantage of the creative community in San Francisco to help them. And even if they didn't have the most like a movie industry, he could like at least mold them and they would like learn to keep up a shop well. It was kind of this lovely place with this stoic walrus man at the figurehead of it. And so tons of people that in the effects industry made their way through M5 on their way to places like ILM or Pixar or Pacific Digital. So it was kind of this fixture, this kind of not underground, but this kind of a clubhouse for the freaks and the misfits that would make their way into movie production. So
this is kind of where we get to at the end of all of this special effects work. Adam Savage said, "The last place I worked in special effects was Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's studio. And getting up there in 1998 was like going to heaven. I mean, this was the best place I ever imagined working, and I had so much fun. But after about 3 years there, I started to get restless and to think about what's next. It's a function of working freelance for 15 years, where you really never knew more than a couple of weeks in advance what the hell you'd be doing. It's always what's next, what's next, what's next." So a couple years later in 2002, Peter Reese is casting Mythbusters and he recalls this interview he does with Jamie Hyneman about
Blendo.
Jamie, he reaches out to Jamie to host this crazy show. Jamie doesn't feel he was dynamic enough to host and knew that he needed a counterpart. And so that is how he ends up hitting up Adam Savage to join him. And Savage said yes. So the next step was for them to put together a demo reel. Savage said, "So the next morning, I went in with my DV camera and we borrowed another one and shot for 2 hours. I came home, cut together a 14-minute demo reel on my laptop, and it was basically all they said was, 'We're thinking about certain kinds of myths and we just want to get you guys on camera talking about a myth.' And what I ended up cutting together is almost exactly what the show is. From the introductions where Jamie is the straight man and I'm kind of goofy, to where I was like, 'You want to blow something up?' And we got some fireworks and blew something up and we ran away while it burned something down. And then we spent like 6 or 7 minutes talking about the lawn chair Larry balloon myth, and the people in Australia saw it and they called up and said, 'We love this. We're putting it forward to Discovery Channel. We think you guys are the guys.' By the way, side note, lawn chair Larry refers to an incident in which a guy made a 45-minute flight in a patio chair with 45 helium-filled weather balloons attached to it. It is a myth they end up exploring on the actual show, I think in the first few episodes."
So the first... Even in that first, those pilot episodes that came out that they called the first season, like,
yes,
Jamie Hyneman is genuinely uncomfortable being on camera. He is stuttering. Uh-huh. He doesn't, like, look to, you know, at the camera. He is visibly weirded out being on camera and having the practicality and foresight to be like, shit, I need just a razzle dazzle man, and getting this hyperactive former child actor / unicyclist magician guy that he used to work with to help him out really is like an amazing bit of foresight that, you know, changed the trajectory of both of their lives. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing.
Another thing to note about those first few episodes is just the fact that, like, no one knows who they are. So they're trying to, like, call up these specialists and stuff, and people aren't returning their phone calls. Adam Savage said, "When we were first starting out, we would call up a scientist for help on some myth, and he would say, 'Why would I want to help you with that? It's stupid.' And we would say, 'Well, we know it's stupid, and you know it's stupid, but a lot of people think this is true, so help us prove it.' And they'd be like, 'Buzz off.'" And you actually see this happen in the first segment of the first episode with the Chevy Impala. They're trying to take a Chevy and see if it can be souped up to go 350 miles per hour, like you might see in a movie. And they have a really tough time literally just getting someone to answer the phone when they call or call them back. And it's kind of hilarious. And so it's really fun to go back to those first episodes for how ragtag it truly is. And they don't make any bones about that either. They're like, "We're a couple of crazy idiots. We're trying to do these things. No one's taking us seriously. We're just going to do it anyway." And then the people they do get to help them are all kind of like strange nomadic types that live out in the desert and also do weird, stupid shit in their free time, like blow things up and whatnot.
So while this is coming together, a spunky redhead is throwing herself in the mix, one that will have changed the romantic trajectories of 1,000 desperate nerds, Carrie Byron.
Yes.
Who lives kind of a life is kind of filled with hardship. Her father was a California area real estate agent who just had a horrible kind of boom and bust life, where when he was selling properties, they would live in a nice big house. And when times were tough, her entire family would be forced to live in a single guest bedroom in a mutual friend's house.
Her grandfather classically lost both of his hands in a machine thrashing incident, ended up getting them replaced with an axe and a gun, respectively, on the left and right hand, because he was indeed pure evil, and he actually ended up being nicknamed the Horror of, Kentucky. He was where he reigned.
So this is from her biography, Crash Test Girl, that I listened to at double speed on Audible because I had a spare credit kicking around. But she leaves the single bedroom where she had to live with her parents as a teenager, tries to live out of her car for a couple of months, popping caffeine pills, working side jobs, and trying to get through school. Her friend is like, this is insanely unsustainable. You just passed out at the wheel and crashed into a tree. Come live with my family. We'll help you out. She does that, makes her way through college, goes finds herself across the world backpacking journey, you know, going to hostels, just doing her thing. And she ends up in the San Francisco area and really is directionless. She's doing office temp work. She's like flipping vintage fashion to secondhand shops. She like vaguely wants to have a career in art, but she doesn't know what she's doing. And all of a sudden, she finds her calling, something where her father's salesmanship and her natural God-given beauty gives her an advantage. And that is as a shot girl for premium liquor brands in the San Francisco area.
Of course.
She has honed her craft of engaging with weird, sweaty nerds with too much money.
And she does get a degree from San Francisco State University in film and sculpture, mm-hmm. for sure. And after that, she ends up spending a year backpacking, mostly in South Asia. She somehow ends up Jamie's...
I'm saying. She's a shot girl. She's making mad money. She got an offer to be a brand ambassador. But deep down, she's like, I want more. I want more. She indulges a intense microfixation on sculpting, and the teacher of a sculpting class she attends works for M5 Industries. On the same day that she gets an offer to become a globetrotting, highly paid brand ambassador for, like, I don't know, let's just say Tanqueray or something, she walks up to Jamie Hyneman and says, I don't have any experience with film. I don't have any experience with practical effects. Here's my sculpture portfolio. Can I intern here? You don't have to pay me. According to her, goes to her portfolio, doesn't look at it, like silent, flipping through each page, grunts, we could work with this on one sculpture, and tells her to come in the next day. That next day is the first day of filming the pilots for Mythbusters.
And she said, and it turns out my first day as an intern was the first day Mythbusters started filming there. They had a little project that they needed a girl for. He did this story called Airplane Toilet, where a larger woman was using an airplane toilet and flushed before standing up and got sucked into it. That's the myth, at least. They needed to make a mold of a behind for the experiment, and I just happened to let them volunteer mine. It was sort of a trade-off. They did a 3D scan of mine, and I was able to work on it on a computer sculpturing software so I could learn the program. I thought no one would see this because it was just a silly little cable show. Didn't know it would end up being the first thing you see when you Google my name 6 years later.
So. Another thing she does, which I, you know, this is one of those Wizard and the Bruiser hustle lessons, is when it was time to film the big finale Jado rocket Chevy sequence in the Mojave Desert, even though she's not on the call sheet, she's just the intern at M5. She drives overnight to the Mojave Desert to meet the film crew and help out with the production. She gets more screen time. The production company is like, hey, this feisty redhead's got, she's got something. Almost as if she understands how to engage with nerds. And when it production in the first season and the second season really kind of highlight just how slow the production process is, because it's Jamie and Adam hand building all of these rigs, doing all these tests and filming all the interstitials, and they just can't churn out episodes fast enough. Even with these massive builds taking, they're doing them in like a 5-day, a week long like sprint, it's still not fast enough. That's when Beyond Productions is like, you need a second team, the build team, and Carrie is called in to join them alongside two builders from ILM that Adam knew, Tori Belleci and Granty Mahar.
Yeah, Belleci joined the show in 2003 behind the scenes. He ends up getting in front of the camera in 2004, one season after Carrie. As a kid, his father showed him how to make a Molotov cocktail when he was a young boy, and he accidentally set the house on fire with a homemade flamethrower. Needless to say, he's always loved stuff that goes bang, and at the age of 19, he was almost arrested for setting off a homemade pipe bomb in his neighborhood of Seaside, California. And the police officer actually arrived on the scene and was like, hey, maybe you should like put this passion into something more legal, like special effects or something like that. So he heads to San Francisco State University's film school and also ends up at Jamie Hyneman's M5 Industries, at first as an errand boy and shop cleaner, but this changed pretty quickly and even landed work at ILM as well for 8 years as a model builder, sculptor, and painter. So it made good friends along the way and that. He worked on a lot of projects that we already talked about with Jamie and Adam, Matrix movies, things of that sort of around that time period. A lot of Star Wars prequels, credits for all these guys. And it was actually Tori Belleci who, is that what it is? Belleci?
Belleci.
Yeah, Belleci. Tori Belleci who brought on fan favorite Grant Imahara, who went to the University of Southern California for electrical engineering and got his first work after college as an engineer on Lucasfilm's THX division, and then, of course, ILM after that. And he worked there for 9 years, again, on a bunch of projects mentioned previously and stuff also like...
It was his responsibility to re-engineer R2-D2 for the prequel movies.
Like, yeah, he was a big R2-D2 guy. That was like one of his huge, huge thing projects that he worked on. He completed the build team, or the B team, as they also call it, for the show, joining in 2005 as a replacement for Scotty Chapman, who was on the show for just two seasons in 04 and 05 and was referred to as the Mistress of Metal. Of course, if you're familiar with the show, you may already know that Grant did suffer an untimely death in 2020 at the age of 49. Carrie said, "Grant left it all on the screen. He was a sweet, intelligent, cool guy. I think the one thing you didn't see is how hard he worked behind the scenes when the cameras were off and how much he really delighted in showing it to other people. Like, kids would come to visit the shop, and even though it'd be his lunch hour, he'd drop what he was doing and he'd be like, 'Oh, check this out. Look at this. Cool, cool.' He really was a teacher, and it showed him what he did, and he really loved kids, and he didn't get to complete his final project, which was creating the Baby Yoda animatronic that he was going to take to children's hospitals. I mean, he was doing that on his own time. This is the kind of thing that he did." Just seemed like such a sweet guy.
I mean, he initially wanted to bring the freakish skeleton robot from the Craig Ferguson show, Jeff Peterson, to children's hospitals, but that was deemed too traumatized.
Speaking of untimely deaths, there was also Jesse Combs, who joined the show for 12 episodes to replace Carrie Byron while she was on maternity leave. She was known as the fastest woman on four wheels and set a woman's land speed class record in 2013 and again in 2016. And she unfortunately ends up passing away after crashing a jet-powered high-speed race car back in 2019 at the age of 39. But all this to say, every single one of these people are... fascinating before the show even starts, right? They all are like totally on a different lane than like any kind of normal Hollywood casting,
yes.
I guess is what I'm getting
at. It's important to note that none of these people are television presenters and none of them are even explicitly scientists.
Even Carrie, like if you were to ask me, I'd be like, oh, she was an actor slash... Mm-hmm. science person, you know what I mean? But like, no, even she was like, I don't know what I'm want to get into in life. I got really into sculpture and again, special effects. So yeah, they're all like more effects people than they are. And then just naturally seem to gravitate to the camera. I mean, they all like look
the
like
fact
they belong
that
they
there. Didn't navigate.
Yeah.
It's, you know, there was so
right,
much reality in the reality show. There's a moment that I'm thinking of where I believe it's the second or third season where they're testing whether or not ancient Mesopotamian batteries were discovered as a working technology on an archaeological site. So they created these like acid metal clay jugs that they were going to see if you could get a voltage out of them. And as a prank, supposedly pushed by one of the producers who wanted to see more drama on screen, they made Adam touch a prototype that was actually connected to power mains and not the the chemical batteries, giving him an insane electric shock. And his sense of hurt and anger at the production team and the guilt on the build team's face when they were like, you know, being like, they can't say the producer made us do it. So they're like, ha ha, funny prank. And he's like cursing it out. He's like running from the camera. Tori constantly hurts himself. He's like doubling over on his bicycle, getting like caught in the nuts by errant toe cables. Adam Savage famously burns off one of his eyebrows and in the immortal line, am I missing an eyebrow?
I'm glad you brought up Jackass. I never didn't think of it like that.
I mean, Tori's in Jackass Forever. He's like an official member of the Jackass crew. He is absolutely the Johnny Knoxville of the Mythbusters team.
Yeah, it makes so much sense looking back on it. You're like, right, that's again and again. The great thing about Jackass is what you were just saying about how like that's because they kind of weren't like these camera ready people initially is what makes it work so well. Just like Jackass makes you feel like you're just hanging out with your friends, kind of get the same effect with them. And it's just that perfect little, they entered right in that perfect sweet spot of reality TV to do this thing. And then, you know, as Carrie puts it, what did she say?
April, I swear to God, you better delete all this dead air and make us look really great, like handsome and smart. I want us to sound handsome.
I was having so much fun and the audience was along for the ride. I like to think of Mythbusters like the cheese sauce on broccoli. It tastes so good that you didn't realize you were eating vegetables. So you're like getting the Jackass thing, but you're also learning shit in this like really, really fun way, which again is just what made it so, so great and so exciting. So of course you just mentioned it. Let's get more into it now. Due to the nature of the show, there were a few instances of mishaps and moments of danger. One legendary incident was talked about by Adam Savage at a Comic-Con when asked about the biggest behind-the-scenes disaster the show ever had. Savage spoke about the show tackling it, quote, an easily available material and its supposed explosive properties. Apparently, what they discovered was so explosive that they actually destroyed the footage that they got and made everyone promise never to speak of it again. And eventually, Savage contacted the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, aka DARPA, to let them know about their findings because they were asking about like anybody having any findings about homemade bombs and stuff. I guess this thing was just so easy to create and was so dangerous that they had to get rid of it. And of course, there is the cannonball incident. The cannonball that was fired into an occupied home. The team were testing out homemade cannons when one, according to Discovery, made, quote, an unforeseen bounce, end quote, and blasted through a cinder block wall, through someone's front yard, up their stairs, through their bedroom, which they were in at the time, and out the back of the house. It managed to hit the top of another home before finally smashing into a parked minivan, which is where it lay, which is totally crazy.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at
the cast in the final reunion episode, because at one point in the later seasons, after contract renegotiations, they actually got rid of the build team and they brought him back for the finale. talked about just the sheer terror in their eyes as, like, you know, they were shooting cannonballs all day doing tests for this thing. It always landed into the side of the hill that they were firing into, thanks to the water barrels and everything that they had to catch them. One, like, kind of flew away and they're like, ah, weird. And then county sheriff, like, cars started piling up and they're like, hey, are you shooting cannonballs? And then news helicopters started circling the chute and they're like, oh my God, did we kill somebody? Oh God, we killed somebody. Oh no.
They almost did. Person was in the bedroom.
Adam Savage and Carrie Byron had to give a talk at a local high school talk about safety and to repair relationship with the communities.
Oh my God. Before that, in 2009, they were experimenting with an explosion in Esparto, California to see if they could literally knock the socks off of a mannequin, and went a little overboard to the point that the explosion shattered a nearby resident's window and knocked said resident off her couch. It's a lot of fun. So another just crazy incident. You already mentioned Terry Bellici being hit in the groin. It's happened several times. A goat kicked him in the nuts. There was a magnet on a kite. There was also a martial arts kick. Bellici said, if I had a nickel for every time I got hit in the testicles on this show, I could retire. I hope I could still have kids. They're like a magnet to flying things. His nuts, that is.
When asked about the most common onset injuries, Heineman actually said that of all things, the ubiquitous plexiglass blast shields that are always present whenever they do any sort of dangerous experiment, the way that the hinges are designed, multiple crew members, including Adam Savage, have broken their fingers getting it caught in between the individual panels that weigh hundreds of pounds apiece.
Adam Savage was actually asked about the most scariest moment he had on the show, and he said that was definitely standing on the deck of the Mythtanic. Savage said, we were testing the myth of will you get sucked down by a boat if it sinks? And the biggest boat we could get a hold of was this steel-hulled tugboat that weighed about 30,000 pounds. And we welded it up and put it in a valve in the base of it that would let water in and started letting it fill up. And I stood on the deck with no protective gear, but a wetsuit, and I had a weight belt on to make sure to account for my positive buoyancy. And we didn't know what was going to happen. We were in San Francisco Bay. It was like 55 degree water. It was 75 feet deep where we were. And Jamie is pretty much right next to me. He's a master diver. And we also had a secondary master diver who's a paramedic and a salvage specialist. And we had no idea what was going to happen. But when you're standing on something that big and it starts to move, in a way you've never felt something like that move, i.e. it starts to roll, your body really knows that something is dreadfully wrong. We had to do it twice because the first time I jumped right off, I was like, screw this. I don't think I really participated in that decision. My body was just like, time to go. And the second time we did it, I felt a little more confident, but still I didn't know if I was going to be dragged down 60 feet or something like that. It was terrifying. So I still have to say that was just about the highest on the Brown Pants Index. That's our index that we call it at MythBusters. I love the Brown Pants Index.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's that. There's so many weird little things that made the show bigger than the sum of its parts. The real danger that you felt the hosts were in. The fact that, like, for a lot of these myths, their builds didn't work as planned. A lot of times, especially in the early seasons, you know, they're on a time crunch. They got to move on to the next myth. They would just fail and just be like, we fucked this up. We'll try and do it over again later, which they would do on kind of myth takes episodes where they would redo things that they had failed in the past. And conversely, the thrill in the team's eyes when something actually works like they want it to, mm-hmm. The actual celebration, you feel it with them because you're on the ground with them as they sweat and toil to build these things. That, you know, you see them, most of the show is them just like muttering over a workbench trying to get these things to work. Another great thing is that early on they realize that even if the myth itself doesn't pan out, you should still give people what they want to see. Where if something is supposedly explosive and it turns out that's just an urban legend, they would just go ahead and fill the thing with actual explosives and in beautiful slow motion footage, blow the thing up anyway, thus giving that kind of ecstatic release. And again, this is pre-science YouTube. This is pre there's so many things that, you know, nowadays, high frame rate footage of a thing going in slow motion, exploding, a million YouTube channels, a million infotainment shows. But Mythbusters really captured that like exotic thrill that modern film technology could capture for a lot of people.
That's the big trick with them, I think, was that in general, it would be like, hey, let's test this thing out. And oftentimes it's like, obviously this isn't going to work. And then it'd be like, wah, wah, it doesn't work. It's like, all right, well, now we're just going to cover it in dynamite. You're like, all right. Like they had an understanding of like heightening the situation to make it more and more interesting. So even like the lamest of and most obvious myths they'd find some place to push it to make for really fun, interesting television. And totally, Jake, that like a big draw is them seeing that live and experiencing that in the moment and seeing genuine excitement from them that was not at all put on in any way, because they were, I think that that's what's so great about them and what, you know, I think a lot of people are drawn to and what we forget to be sometimes as human beings. There's just endless curiosity. And like, that's so, so important to continue to maintain within yourself. And they're just always showing you that on the show, that it's great to be curious in these ways.
One of the things we mentioned putting on something, and that is the relationship between Adam and Jamie, where when Mythbusters was finally off the air, people were like, oh my God, the band's breaking up. Oh my God, do Adam and Jamie, are they like not getting along well? The thing is, they didn't get along from the beginning. The same Christian Science Monitor article from 2006 just flat out says that these are two extremely opposite people. Peter Reese, the original creator of the show who developed it, says they're the Oscar and Felix of myth-busting. Reese says, the two are diametrically opposed in every aspect of their lives. Jamie is all about total, complete, and utter control, thinking first and then acting. Adam is about acting first and then thinking. Without prodding, Heinemann says, I wouldn't spend 5 minutes with Adam outside work if I didn't have to.
Yeah.
Followed by, but yet I feel somewhat displaced without him in the workplace, destroying my tools and leaving messes everywhere he goes.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Oh, do you have more?
No, just the fact that like they were coworkers. They, you know, understood.
Yeah, they were coworkers through and through. Yeah.
They appeared often in, you know, they'd make appearances for various TED Talks, corporate events, guest roles on TV shows. Like, they were a duo in the eyes of the public, but they never engaged with each other when off the clock.
It should also be noted that Jamie is also not hanging out with a lot of people. He's a very private person. He said, like, just so you know, like, at all times, I'd rather be sitting in a dark room, like, thinking about shit, you know, as opposed to interacting with people. So it's not necessarily like he is fundamentally is not. In fact, it's kind of a miracle he made it so long on the show that they went all the way to, what, 2016 from 2003. He, you know, definite fact that Carrie has talked about and others is that, you know, do not expect a Mythbusters reunion on like much of a, yeah, like at all. It's not gonna happen, or at least don't expect the show to come back with the original cast minus obviously Imahara, because Jamie is totally done with television and just as a whole. And I believe Carrie mentioned that he now works in like think tanks, and kind of thing he's
absolutely
really into.
For a hot second after the show, Adam and Jamie were involved in the YouTube channel and website called Tested. Jamie quickly left, and it's basically become the Adam Savage show on that YouTube channel for a while. He has tons of science videos, tons of Q&A sessions, cosplay videos, like it's his own little nerd playground, and Jamie quickly left. Jamie works for like the defense industry. He has mentioned that he has like innovative drone designs. He has an idea for a autonomous tank filled with water that can like be sent into burning forests and like keep firefighters out of danger. Like, he is overjoyed just engineering and tinkering and building, still in his M5 offices. So like, Adam's happy, Jamie's happy. We really don't need a reunion. Like, there is hundreds of hours of television of these two people blowing stuff up in a formal setting. I don't begrudge it. And the fact that there was never really a true falling out, like from the beginning, all the way back in 2006, they just have it all out on the table that like we are co-hosts, not like buddies.
Right. And that's totally fine. I totally get that. Apparently they argued a lot on and off screen. One fundamental thing that they agreed on was the ethics of the show. They would never do a sponsored myth. They would never allow for anything like that to happen, for there to be any kind of, sellout situation.
I mean,
they
would do corporate appearances for like Corning and Intel. Like they got their they got their bag.
They got their nut. But yeah, that one thing, they didn't bring it into the show in that way, which I thought was kind of cool that they said that. At least that's what Adam Savage said, was like their one fundamental thing that they always agreed on. Either Adam or Jamie said that. But that's
another thing that I admire the show for was an early disregard for like what they called oogie boogie myths, kind of anything having to do with New Age mysticism or magic or ghosts or telepathy in a lot of ways. They experimented a little bit with it. They mentioned the in the early seasons, they did one about pyramid power and whether putting things under supposedly magical pyramids that they bought off the internet could like help preserve food or induce positive energy.
But apparently Adam, that's like the one he regrets doing.
Yeah.
Too.
There was another one where they tested free energy devices, and him and Jamie, especially, I think also part of this like 2000s new atheism wave was like, no, magic is not real. We're not testing magic.
We can't get into all that. Yeah. But what they did test was pretty great. Let's talk about some particularly enjoyable episodes. There's way too many to count. It's the kind of show you literally just throw it on and let it run for hours and hours and hours. Like I said, it's almost 300 episodes worth of material. It's kind of ridiculous. But if you want to maybe get a little starter going, I've got a few suggestions for you. First of all, there's Alcatraz Escape, Season 2, Episode 8. The team recreates the incredible Escape from Alcatraz performed by Frank Morris and the Anglin brothers, including using an inflatable raft made from rubber raincoats that was used across the San Francisco Bay at night. They waited until nightfall. They actually do it. It's kind of incredible to see. MacGyver Myths, Season 5, Episode 31, a great example of the team taking on TV myths. These are all, of course, pertaining to the show MacGyver, which is, if you don't know, it's an old action show where the star can get out of any situation using whatever is around him at the time. There is, for you nerds out there, there's the Star Wars special, Season 12, Episode 1. I think this is especially cool because of all of their lineage, you know, coming from Industrial Light and Magic to work on the show. They ended up getting like really great access to the whole IP and were able to test out a bunch of fun stuff, like whether the Ewoks could have taken down those chicken walkers on Endor, or how easy it would be to actually dodge a stormtrooper blaster fire, and myth busted. It would actually be very hard to dodge those blasters. You would probably actually, all those people would actually probably die at those, in those different scenes in those movies.
One that I really appreciated was from 2008, where they tested the NASA moon landing and went kind of point by point on key moon landing conspiracy theories and points of conspiracy evidence and debunked them kind of one by one, which I found like kind of refreshing and practical. Another one, episode 33 from 2005, where they went through the supposed advice for if your plane is going to crash, what's the best position to sit in to like survive the crash? And they busted it, saying that there is a tiny grain of truth that like tucking your hand, your head into your lap and just like bracing, maybe, just maybe, will leave you with a broken neck and shattered bones, and you might live, maybe, depending on where you're sitting in the cabin. But otherwise, if your plane is crashing, there's no like hacks to get out of being severely injured.
For some car stuff, speed cameras. This Season 5, Episode 4 is a great one concerning fast cars, testing out things about speed cameras, but also just a great episode for gearheads to like watch people driving real, real fast. And another good car one is Season 12, Episode 12, called Road Rage, and it recreates a bunch of action film stunts using cars. So there's, and I feel like they did so many of that stuff, like out in the desert, giant vehicles exploding, doing wild stuff with various modes of transportation was a Mythbusters classic.
One I think about all the time was 2010's Flu Fiction, in which Adam was wearing a rig that had fluorescent dye dripping near his nose, and he would touch his nose and touch things around him, shake people's hands. And at the end of the experiment, where he hosted a fake dinner party, they turned on a black light and the entire room was just glowing green to just showcase how much like germs can travel if you're not being careful, not washing your hands and just like touching shit, which in these days, I think about it a lot.
Yeah. So the original team did the show up through 2016 before they stepped away and were replaced by hosts John Leung and Brian Loudon for two seasons, with the show finally coming to a close in 2018. They were chosen via a reality competition show called Mythbusters The Search, where they had a competition. They'd be given different myths to bust, these different teams, and whoever performed that the best would get to stay on. And, you know, they were narrowed down to two. In 2018, Adam Savage returned to host a new spinoff called Mythbusters Junior, which ran for a season and had Savage leading a team of children and testing out different myths.
I watched one episode and it made me sad because half of it was them just showing footage from old Mythbusters episodes.
Yeah. Unfortunately, as we said, the possibility of a true return to form is almost definitely not going to happen. But you do have that White Rabbit. What was it? The White Rabbit Project.
Yeah.
You have that. You have various things. Carrie even says that she still works with Bellucci, and they like continue to pitch Mythbusters adjacent type shows. Mm-hmm. So I think we will get more of them in our future for sure, as they're still working in the industry. And Adam Savage is still working on stuff as well. Jamie, I think, is done for goodsies in terms of TV, but you never know.
Jamie's like on a helicopter above Libya right now, like building a fucking cyborg robot. He's doing wet work shit, man.
I have one more final quote from Carrie, but do you have anything else you wanted to talk about before we close this puppy up? Any more Jake fast factoids, lightning Jake round of insane, intense fact emotions? That's what I call
them. Fun fact, this show was a great comfort to me during a very dark period in my life. The just reliability of it, the friendliness of the hosts, and the, I would say now, hopeful belief in the power of human ingenuity and reason in the face of darkness was very nice, and I miss that feeling.
Funny, mine was Trailer Park Boys, much more nihilistic approach to the dark time, but it got me through for sure. Just chain smoking in my bed, watching Trailer Park Boys, drinking Bud Lights, my friend. That is that was a summer. All right, well, here's a little final quote from Carrie before we wrap things up. Carrie said, Mythbusters was an incredible opportunity, but a lot of it was right time, right place, hard work, and the fact that we were starting out this reality show during the Wild West of reality. We were lucky enough not to be drowned out by a gazillion stations and the internet. We had a bigger audience because there was less to watch. We got to throw up in... We got to grow up into the show.
I mean, they also throw up. There were a lot of throw up vomiting quite a bit. Myths.
Now, I think it's a lot harder for people to get to that point. So I'm going to say I was lucky to be in the era that I was in, and I count my blessings for it. I got amazing opportunities, and I still continue to get to meet the most interesting people in the world. Also, Carrie Byron's grandfather, the axe-handed, gun-handed maniac, had this to say. I'll kill them all! Which I thought was interesting. I will mention too, we went and watched one of the like first episodes of Mythbusters, and it was kind of amazing to see just how of its time it was as a reality show. Like, it reminded me, the editing of it and the look of it reminded me of like Road Rules. You know? And so it's interesting, I think, to watch that show evolve over time as reality evolved. And I never thought of it as much of a reality show, but you actually do see it change as that whole genre changed. And it kind of started as in the earliest phases of that genre.
I mean, it should be noted that like shows like Mythbusters and Dirty Jobs, and I'm missing a ton of other major hits, kind of boosted the Discovery Channel into its like insane heights, where the point is now it's like this massive player. You know, it's got, it's now part of Warner Brothers Discovery, you know, part of this massive media engine that contains HBO and CNN and Cartoon Network and all these other things. There was a massive announcement where it's probably going to get folded into HBO Max. Like, without Mythbusters, like, the entire fortunes of the Discovery Channel really was on thin ice back in the early 2000s, and they kind of turned it around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still felt to this day.
Hell yeah.
So the next time you watch someone on YouTube film themselves dumping lithium batteries into a bucket of salt water and filming the explosion, thank Mythbusters.
Yes. And of course, you've always wondered if a man with a gun for a hand and an axe for a hand could murder an entire town in Kentucky. Myth not busted.
Plausible.
He did it.
Plausible.
He killed them all.
It's plausible. There's no...
I'm coming for you, Jake. I hope you don't scream too loud.
Can I get your granddaughter's phone number before you kill me?
Nope. Go, 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 go. That's the sound of him killing Jake. Anyways, thank you so much for listening to our Mythbusters episode and for all your support. If you'd like to support us further, patreon.com/whizbrew is the place to be. $5 a month, you get bonus weekly episodes from Jake and I. Talk about the stuff we're currently watching and playing, talk about the news, talk about different years in media and breaking all that down. It's a lot of fun. For $15, you can join us on our Sunday study group. This last Sunday, we on Discord, we got together and watched a few Mythbusters episodes, and it was super, super fun. It was just such a nice hang. I loved it. It was the Mythbusters, the perfect Sunday afternoon
the
thing. I mean, it just really is.
From the Discord chat, as a collective, when we realized that you could turn a gun barrel around 180 degrees like Bugs Bunny, and it would turn and it would cleanly shoot you in the face.
That blew me away. That was so crazy. Anyways, check us out on there, patreon.com/whizbrew. Check me out on Twitch, twitch.tv/HoltonHersHo. Monday, Tuesday, Friday streams. It is a blast, and I love having Whizbrew folks. Every time, literally every stream I do, it seems that lately I have at least one or two people come on for the first time and say, what's up? Just listen to the Blockbuster episode. It's very cool to see you playing some games and hanging out. And it's great to see you there in chat. So thank you so much. Twitch.tv/HoltonHersHo. Jake?
Hey, I stream too. I do a VTuber channel. It's twitch.tv/PuppetJared or youtube.com/PuppetJared. Whatever your flavor, whatever app is on your TV, just check it out. The flagship stream is Cartoon Dumpster Thursdays, where we watch the weirdest cartoons from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, and we have ourselves a blast. Likewise, it is very fun when a Whizbrew listener pops in and says, hey, I heard you pitch this for a year straight, and I finally got off my ass and watched, and I'm having the time of my life. I'm doing great. I'm feeling better. My wife loves me again. God, this stream is so entertaining.
I don't know about that promo, but I guess we'll give it a go. But check out Puppet Jared, everybody. And hey, always remember, never stop bruising.
And keep on whizzing.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.